Welcome to CoreCast, Seton Hall University's podcast series supporting the university core curriculum. Produced by the Institute for Communication and Religion and generously funded by the Division of Academic Affairs, each episode will bring a faculty expert together with a student leader to discuss and explore a core text. The Catholic intellectual tradition is rich and varied, and actively seeks to engage all global wisdom traditions. Join us in learning about Scripture and the world's greatest works of philosophy and literature.
Well, thanks so much for joining us on the CoreCast podcast. My name is Bernie Wagenblast. Last time we had one of these podcasts, we were talking about an allegory. Today we're going to be talking about something a little bit different. I'm joined by Dr. Nancy Enright. She is the director of the University Core and professor of English at Seton Hall University, and Frank Hunter, who is a graduate student and teacher of Latin. Frank, Nancy, welcome to the CoreCast podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, I just want to say I'm really excited to be here with Frank. Frank and I met in my Core 3 class several years ago, which was on Fantasy and Faith, on the works of Tolkien and Lewis. But he is also a Latin scholar, and he is now in the graduate program in English, and we're working on a book project together on this text. So he has done a translation of this text that we teach in Core 2. So it's a really exciting thing to be presenting with Frank on the text of Perpetua. And I'm going to let him talk about, you know, what the text actually is.
Sure.
He's so close to it right now.
So the Passion of Perpetua and Felicity is an early Christian text. It kind of borders, it straddles the ancient world and the medieval world in many ways. And we'll get to that, I'm sure, throughout the podcast. But the text itself is a strange story. Strange as in it's only 21 paragraphs long, which we constitute as chapters, and has three authors. So a text that's that short, having three authors, has something profound about it. If not profound, then something superficially unnecessary. So there's a didactic purpose of this text. It introduces what appears to be excerpts of a diary from this Saint Perpetua through one of the minor persecutions in the late 2nd century AD. So this text, the purpose of it is written out in the first paragraph, and that is to teach Christians and non-Christians for the further building of the church and the faith, and it focuses around three visions of Perpetua. So it's very interdisciplinary. It brings together theology with literature, women and gender studies, and general religious, I guess you can say, ecumenical dialogue in order to teach about the witness of these Christians in the early church against persecution. So it's a wonderful text. It's had a profound influence on me, as many of the core texts have, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Well, for someone who is not familiar with this story, tell me a little bit, what is the story? Who is Perpetua? Why is she special?
Well, Perpetua was a young woman in Carthage. She was 22. She was a young mother nursing a baby. And she was in a noble family, an aristocratic family. And she did something that was quite shocking for that time. She joined this new religion, Christianity, which was not accepted by the Roman Empire. It was being persecuted, sometimes more aggressively than others. This, as Frank said, was a minor persecution, if you want to say, in this city of Carthage, which was part of the Roman Empire. But Perpetua and a group of her companions were arrested, and they were imprisoned and then ultimately executed for their beliefs. She wrote a journal in prison, and that's the heart of like this threefold text that Frank was talking about. The bulk of it is her journal.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as we know, it's the first writing by a Christian woman.
Mm.
And so it's very important on that level, and it's extremely important in terms of looking at how the early church functioned and the sense of community and how there's a tremendous amount of love among these people, which interestingly, you know, she's an aristocrat, but there's a couple of slaves who converted, and they're all very much one community. So there are so many things about the text that's fascinating. And I have to say, I read it for the first time when I was 11 years old.
Oh, wow.
I got it in a book, Lives of Saints, and I was so taken with the courage of this young woman, and mm-hmm. she became like sort of a hero to me. So for me, it has a very personal connection.
Now, you mentioned that she's an aristocrat. The fact that she was an aristocrat obviously did not make any difference in terms of how her story ended, did it?
No, certainly not. So the term for aristocrat, more specifically here, that the Romans would have used is patrician. She was from one of the patrician families, coming from the word pater, meaning the families of the founding fathers, essentially, ideally it means. Whether or not they connected back to the founding of Rome or not isn't necessarily, well, we're not quite sure. Some historians, like Edward Gibbon, argues that Nero and Caligula and those emperors actually killed off all the original families, but that's neither here nor there. So being a patrician, she would have had a connection to the culture itself, and you can say the status quo in a way of maintaining that. So for her conversion, it was seen as being something quite scandalous, really, mm-hmm. because the patrician, the aristocratic class, was seen as being the upholders of the pagan religious cults at the time. And by cults, I mean the small sects devoted to each god and to the pagan republican, well, quasi-republican under the imperial system. So for a patrician to convert, especially before the mass conversion with Constantine, about 150 years from this event, you see something that's, you see a major change in the political structure of the Roman Empire as well starting. And that's why I think that Perpetua was treated so especially horribly by the Roman proconsul in Carthage. I mean, for instance, we see what's most unique about Perpetua's patrician heritage in the text is in one of the dreams written by one of the authors of the text, Sertorius. He sees Perpetua writing and speaking in Latin and Greek to the souls of bishops and teachers as they're in this Edenic type of place, which is interesting because it also shows that she's bringing some form of high liberal arts education over to these Christian martyrs. And in this text too, as Dr. Enright was saying, what's so unique is you actually see a woman leader in the church, which gives us early precedent to dispel many of the false accusations against Christianity as being inherently misogynistic. So coming from that patrician class family, she clearly takes on the role of a leader among the many servants and soldiers and priests and, frankly, foreigners who are in prison with her at the same time.
This story is also known as The Passion of Perpetua and Felicity. Mm-hmm. Who's Felicity?
Well, Felicity was a slave. She's one of the two slaves who were part of the group. And scholars seem to believe that she was actually the slave in the household of Perpetua. So here you have the you know, the lady of the house, so to speak, and or the daughter of the family, and one of the slaves. And they were arrested together because they were learning the faith together as what they call catechumens. They still mm-hmm. use the same word today. They were not yet baptized. They get baptized in prison. So this young woman, Felicity, and Perpetua, they join together as sisters. And I think that's part of what the early church brought to the Roman world that was truly, from the Roman point of view, scandalous, because they were those barriers broke down. Mm-hmm. And I think if you read the New Testament, if you read even this text, which I encourage anybody to read, it's a fascinating text, you'll see that, you know, it broke down all of those sort of social divisions. And as Frank mentioned, Perpetua shows a leadership for a woman that was very unusual in the Roman times. Like, women were very, very much second-class citizens. But they did have leadership roles in the early church. But Felicity, as a slave, what's particularly interesting, too, is that she was pregnant. And that becomes an important part of the story, because pregnant women, they had a rule that pregnant women could not be killed in the arena. And so that would have meant that she would be killed if she didn't give birth before the execution date. She'd have to be killed later, perhaps among other types of criminals, not with her brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. as she would see it. So that's a part of the story where everybody prayed that she would give birth soon, which she did, and was able to be executed with the group. And that was very important to her. Mm-hmm. She and Perpetua are depicted together. We have a painting of them in the core office.
Oh.
It's quite lovely.
The two of them are considered martyrs, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What is a martyr, and why is this definition important in the early church?
Well, martyr comes from Greek word martyrion. It refers to a witness. So someone who's a martyr is someone who bears testimony with his or her own life, literally, in a literal sense. Not just bearing testimony and testifying to it in the way that St. John says in the beginning of his gospel, that the Word was made man and then John was sent to testify to the Word, but literally in the sense that someone's life is given up as a form of testimony or witness to the validity of the Christian faith. So Perpetua and Felicity are known as martyrs, and they have their passion, which is from another word, a Latin verb actually, forgetting the word, passionis is the noun form, I'm forgetting the verb form nonetheless, which means a suffering. So its martyrdom is seen as being innately connected with an idea of suffering as a testimony of the validity of something or of the truth behind something. And that's what I think is behind the entire nature of the hagiography, which is a radical breaking from the classical literature of which many people would have been studying and reading and would have been the standard of education among the Roman upper classes at this time.
Mm-hmm. Part of this story involves visions that Perpetua had. Tell me a little bit about that part of it, what they revealed, and how do they move the story forward?
Well, I have a lot to say to this, but would you like to talk
No, you go ahead, Frank.
Well, I'll start off with a controversial literary opinion that I have, and I was actually speaking with Dr. Enright about this the other day, that I think all great literature has a pre-lapsarian urging, meaning that it strives in some capacity, whether consciously or subconsciously, to get back to the Garden of Eden. So we see this with, to connect it with another cortex, and really my favorite poem, in Dante's Divine Comedy. We see this when Dante reaches Eden at the top of Mount Purgatory before he's transported to behold the beatific vision. That is the blessed sight of the Lord's face, of God's face. But in these visions, Perpetua is doing something aesthetically and literarily profound. And that's not to invalidate the legitimacy of her visions. I believe that she genuinely had these visions. But in writing these visions, she's engaging within that pre-lapsarian tradition. So each of these visions has some sort of imagery, some sort of signs and symbolism that lead or suggest a return to Eden, a return back to paradise. So her three major visions include the scaling of a ladder, of which on the bottom there's a serpent, and on top is this celestial garden, which is clearly a sign of Eden. A second one is a vision of an old man dressed as a shepherd, surrounded by men and women in white robes, shining brightly as stars, in this garden that seems to be on top of the ladder, almost picking up from there. And then the last vision, which I think sticks most potently in people's minds, is that of Perpetua being transformed into a gladiator to fight what's called the Egyptian, this monstrous type of figure with biblical typology, of whom she defeats and then is crowned with a laurel by this incarnation of this giant figure who is seen to be God. So rather than talking about each of these visions in detail, each one, especially with the notion of the latter, suggests some sort of striving and struggle to get to an eternal reward. And that eternal reward is always seems to be, I guess you could say, herbal. It always seems to have something Edenic about it, whether it's the actual climbing up a ladder into a garden or the reception of, well, what the Latin says is a cheese curd, which is really the Eucharist, I think, in symbolism, from this old man in this beautiful garden where there's all these other angels and saints. And then finally, upon defeating this Egyptian, quote-unquote, monster, the reception of a branch as a form of victory. Now, granted, that's also a sign of divinity in the classical sense, in a pagan sense, but also there seems to be an idea of a branch perhaps from the tree of life or from the tree of knowledge given to Perpetua in some way. So all of these visions seem to hint at an eternal reward that's given to the martyrs through suffering and through their death and testimony. And after these visions, and along with each one, as Perpetua, as the leader of these martyrs, reported to them, they all begin to rejoice and have this radical acceptance, I like to think of it, of their martyrdom, to the point of where, and this is something I struggled with as a student reading this, it almost seemed to me as though they sought out martyrdom. Mm-hmm. But upon growing up, I can say that, and maturing and studying the text in the original languages, it became clear to me that it wasn't a seeking out of martyrdom. It was through divine revelation in some way, through this pre-lapsarian revelation of where they're going to wind up, through their testimony, that there's nothing to fear in death, and that death, being something that's inevitable, should be something that's embraced when its proper time comes.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to say it makes me so happy as the director of the choir to hear a student say that he was thinking about this text years later after mm-hmm. taking Court 2. So just let me say that, Frank, you made me very, very happy.
Well, to further that, I also teach this text in my Latin classes sometimes.
happier still. And because I think it's a very neglected text. And I think, you know, that is really one of the things that's most striking about it is how these martyrs looked at their death as a victory. They would talk about it as a crown of martyrdom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were 10 major Roman persecutions. and then sporadic smaller ones in between. This was like an all-out effort by the Roman Empire to stamp out what they saw as a radical and revolutionary and dangerous cult. And it was not successful. As Tertullian said, who's another core author, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. It actually drew more people in. And so even in this story, at the end of the story, the third writer who takes up, you know, obviously they couldn't describe their own deaths. So mm-hmm. somebody was witnessing their deaths and wrote it down. We don't know who that was. But that person describes the courage of their deaths. And there's even like one of the jailers who has by this point converted, mm-hmm. and one of the martyrs gives him his ring, dips it in his own blood, and gives it to this man. Now this is a Roman jailer mm-hmm. who is converted, you know, mm-hmm. and it talks about how also when the two women came out, and they put them with an animal that was a female animal to sort of mock, that says to mock their gender, like it was like a, you know, purposely like a mad heifer they put them with.
And the most savage cow, it
yeah,
says here.
Yeah, most savage cow. Yep. It was meant to sort of degrade them in a special way. But it says that the spectators were even like kind of upset by mm-hmm. seeing these young women come out partially clad and so forth. So there was an opposite effect, mm-hmm. and it actually tended to draw people in. But it is, as Frank said, it is, I think sometimes people reading it for the first time will say, like, they almost seem glad about it. It's not that they're glad to suffer exactly, but they're glad to be able to make a sacrifice for their faith. And it's a you know, the word passion means suffering here, but it also, I think, connects with our word, the way we use passion today. There was like mm-hmm. a passionate love for God and for each other that is very, it seeps off every page of this.
Well, you know, to go off of that, I found the line in the text with that passionate love and that radical acceptance. I'll just read the Latin briefly for a second, because I can't do anything without saying any type of Latin. Perpetua's death itself is read as et erantem dexterum tyrinculi gladiatoris ipsa in jugulum sum transtulit, which is the action is the hand of a novice gladiator. Perpetua herself guides the sword so that he may bear it down into her neck, or we have in jugulum here, into her jugular, literally, so that she seems to almost encourage this type of death. And I said my first time reading is, wait a second, this is suicide. But like I said before, upon growing up, maturing with it and reading it more closely, I really found that it was an acceptance here. Do it to make it quickly so that I may be with my Lord, mm-hmm. so that I may be where I'm meant to be. I can be where those visions have taken me. That this act, the assault from this heifer, this mocking beast, any type of comparison to a beast, by the way, in the ancient sense, is always derogatory. There's not a single one that is uplifting, even that of a sheep. Nonetheless, through that mocking attack by a beast, by this heifer, and through the death by a novice gladiator, a young gladiator, meaning an inexperienced, doesn't probably know how to kill, she is radically accepting her eternal reward. This is that ladder in the first vision that's lined with daggers, of which the serpent lies beneath, that she needs to ascend in order to get to paradise, or Eden, as I call it.
Mm-hmm. Nancy, I want to ask sort of a personal question. You talk about how this story is so important in terms of early Christian women in the church and what that means. For you as a woman, is there a certain resonance with this story?
Absolutely. You know, as I said, I read it first when I was 11. And, you know, I think young girls always look for female heroes. Books, you know, it's gotten better now, but, like, I teach children's literature, actually. But, like, books often would have the boy as the hero, the male hero. And what was powerful to me about this story as a young girl is that I just saw women that were so incredibly brave. And as Frank said, Perpetua is actually the leader of the group, even though five of the group are men. So that is interesting in terms of gender. It's also interesting in terms of the relationships Perpetua has with her family. In the Roman times, the father was absolutely the head of the household, the paterfamilias. When a child would be born, they would lay the child at the father's feet, and he would decide whether it would live or die. Infanticide was really common. Often, if it was a girl, the child would be exposed. Perpetua, unlike some girls, enjoyed the favor of her father. Her father was very close to her, but he was a pagan, and he did not want her to do this. So a big part of the journal, an important part, includes these encounters with her father. And so her father would go to the prison begging her to not, to renounce her faith. He loves her, and he doesn't want her to die. And he actually goes when she's at the tribunal. He goes and he tries to convince her again, and he's actually beaten from the podium. He is in agony about what she's doing. And her encounter with her father is very moving, because she loves her father, but she really won't deny her faith. Some scholars, and I don't agree with them, but some scholars have said they don't believe the text could have been written by a Roman woman, because they said no Roman woman at that time would have dared to talk to, sort of defy her father that way. But I disagree with that, and I know Frank does too.
Well, Christ says in the gospel that I've come to turn fathers against sons, mothers against daughters, daughters against mothers, and families against themselves. He brings the sword. I think because of that, with this embrace of the faith, that it's certainly plausible.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the identity she has in Christ is the dominant identity, and I think that's really interesting. And it's also, she sees herself as a Christian before she sees herself as anything else. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think there is a verse in the New Testament, in Christ there is no male or female. She's not just a daughter, she's not just a wife or a mother. She has a child, and one of her big concerns is her baby that was nursing. And so they let her have the baby in prison for a while. This is, again, something as a woman that I identify with as a mother myself, that she's concerned about her baby who is not with her, and if a nursing baby is going to be perhaps in danger. So she was allowed to have the baby in prison. But her father, as part of the leverage he was trying to use against her, said he would not bring the baby anymore. So that was very hard for her, the baby at that point was stopped needing to nurse, and she talks about how her breasts no longer hurt her. A very personal detail,
yeah,
which to me confirms the validity of the text in terms of it's being written really by the person that it's supposed to be written by, a young woman who was nursing a baby, because it's a very very pointed detail, and that comforted her. So I think there are some of these details that they're very important in terms of seeing what she was suffering personally. She talks about how when her father was beaten by the Romans, when he was trying to dissuade her, she said, "I felt like I was being beaten myself." But she still would not renounce.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about the other two writers? You talk about the third writer, obviously, who carries the rest of the story after their martyrdom. What do we know about the other two writers?
Well, the three writers include St. Perpetua, St. Sertorius, who he only wrote a few chapters, I think four at most. Then the other one is an anonymous author. I call him, in the volume we're working on, I call him the compiler or the editor. We don't know who he or she is. For a while it was thought that this compiler of these texts may have been Tertullian, but there's not enough evidence that Tertullian was so familiar with the text itself rather than with the event of Perpetua's martyrdom in Carthage. So we don't know who this person is. I would assume that this compiler must have been a cleric or a bishop in the church, since he puts out from the very start that the purpose is didactic, for the edification, the construction, and the building of the church, to illustrate that the blood of the martyrs is the foundation of the church, so that this would be an inspiring tale. Whoever the compiler was also is also someone who is extremely educated and extremely literate, because in writing this sort of text, it's a very biblical text, even though not biblical in many ways, rather than classical. The reason I say that is because the language becomes very simple and the topic becomes very exemplary rather than ideological. So if we look within the Roman sphere of classical literature, at this time especially, Virgil and Cicero would have been, I guess you can say, the equivalent of Shakespeare and Milton for English. They would have been the standard, the most excellent form of what should be taught and what should be written. Now, we have archetypal examples in that, a psychological lens of either analyzing ideas or through characters themselves, such as Virgil's Aeneas is a psychological archetypal figure to embody the notion of pietas, or devotion in a Roman sense, and Cicero writes many dialogues where he uses great Roman heroes to speak great ideas, but their language is extremely, I suppose you could say, affluent, even though that may not be the word I'm looking for. Their language is extremely complicated, very literate, very performative, whereas this is very straight to the point, very standard. It's almost an imitation of a sort of biblical type of language itself. So it seems that whoever this compiler is writing towards a different audience, whereas Virgil and Cicero are writing for those who are more educated, for those who are going to run the Roman government, run the law courts, or as St. Augustine did, was a rhetorician, a rhetor. Whoever was the author of this sought to convert, sought to teach the faithful through a simple language and a simple story that, although in its linguistic and appearing academic simplicity, is compelling. I mean, St. Augustine speaks about the biblical text in this way in his Confessions, because he was educated in Cicero and Virgil, who he models his Confessions on Virgil's Aeneid in some ways, and he is extremely influenced by Cicero, especially his Hortensius, but that's for another time. Where he speaks about the biblical text as being so simple that in his arrogance of Virgilian and Ciceronian studies, that he thought it was too simple for a man of his erudition. So we see here, there's certainly a purpose here in whoever this editor or compiler was to convert and to educate perhaps the uneducated, as we see is mostly the group of those who Perpetua was leading into their martyrdom.
This story comes from the 3rd century. The story of martyrs goes back to Jesus' disciples, Peter, Paul as examples, and it continues to this day. Why do you think the story of martyrs plays such a role, not only in the early church, but in the church up to this day?
Well, that's a really great question, and I think that's something that we look at a lot in the core. We have modern martyrs, if you want to say. Oscar Romero, the martyred bishop of San Salvador.
The martyrs from ISIS as well, the 50 martyrs, the Coptic
martyrs. Yeah, there's modern martyrs. And Martin Luther King, I would consider a martyr. We have an event at Seton Hall every year called Romero King Week, mm-hmm. and we have like a week and a half really between the two assassination dates of Romero, which is March 24th, and King's assassination, April 4th, and we have vigils on the green to commemorate them. And one of the things, you know, that as Frank mentioned, the Coptic martyrs, that's another example there. People die for the faith all the time, within this last year, we have one of our faculty is from Nigeria, and she has talked about how often priests are killed, you know, mm-hmm. in Nigeria. So, like, what is the meaning of that? It's someone whose faith means so much to them that they're willing to give up life for it. And Martin Luther King actually said, if you don't have something you're willing to die for, you don't have something to live for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to agree with that, I think simply as anything, people don't die for something that they're not 100% convinced is true.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's as simple as that. I think that Christianity in many ways is very unique in that aspect. Not to say that other religious traditions or even philosophical traditions don't themselves have martyrs, but Christianity glorifies the notion of the martyrs, especially through our communion of saints, which we recite whenever we pray the Apostles' Creed, that all of these saints, all of these martyrs, and Christianity, I think, is unique in perhaps the quantity of martyrs it's had, which is a testimony to the persecution the faith has received and to the endurance of the faith itself, that it has so many people who are so convinced of its validity that they would be willing to die for it.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we're coming up to the end of the podcast, but I want to thank both of you very much for sharing this story. Hopefully, people will be encouraged to research it a little bit more and learn a little bit more about the story of Perpetua and Felicity and their martyrdom and all that goes into that. You've been listening to the CoreCast podcast from Seton Hall University. My name is Bernie Wagenblast. Our guests today have been Dr. Nancy Enright. She is the director of the University Core and a professor of English here at Seton Hall University, as well as Frank Hunter, a graduate student, as well as a teacher of Latin, as we could hear when he was reading some of those Latin texts. We thank you very much for joining us. This, again, is something that will be continuing. I also want to thank our engineer, Frank Scafidi. We've been recording this at the studios of WSOU in South Orange, New Jersey. Thanks again for listening, and please join us again next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.